With me to talk about Governor Brewer's plans for the immediate future and what she needs to do to cement her legacy are Chris Hurstom, former member of the Arizona Board of Regents and Chief of Staff for former Governor Fife Symington, and David Shapiro, former state lawmaker and currently the Assistant Superintendent at Mesa's East Valley Institute of Technology. Good morning to you both. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Chris, let's start off with you. Just some brief thoughts on the Governor's State of the State address. Was it anything out of the ordinary, anything special stand out for you?
Well, it was the governor's last State of the State speech.
We presume, yes.
We presume. She was very coy in her refusal to admit that she can't run again, and she gave us a teaser in it, but she isn't going to run again. I think next month she'll announce that she's not running. And by the way, I wouldn't be surprised if she endorsed Mayor Scott Smith at the same time. But I think it was a well-written, well-delivered speech. And it would be what you would expect for a governor in their last term, as you mentioned at the beginning of the show today. Pretty much what you'd expect with regards to trying to tout her past and dealing with the economy and so forth. I will say that when she talks about how her administration has done such a great job dealing with the recession, and I think that she has done a solid job with that. We should always remember that the recession hit government finances very hard, but that we got $3 billion during the recession from the federal government, from the Obama stimulus packages. Where would we have been without the $3 billion in stimulus funds? And the governor, to her credit, led the charge for the penny on the sales tax, which the people voted for, and she supported strongly. And that gave us another $3 billion over 3 years. So those were really the two items that bridged the gap to a slow recovery, and I think she failed to mention that.
And David, a couple of thoughts on the State of the State?
Well, I thought it was well written, her typical delivery with verbal hiccups, although I think we're kind of used to it at this point. But really, what was most surprising to me was it seemed short, even if it wasn't. I mean, it was like 32 or 33 minutes in length. It seemed relatively short and relatively non-substantive, which I think is a real indication that she gets it, that she's not running for re-election, that she's not allowed to run for re-election. Even the CPS piece, which everyone saw, the air was sucked out of the room. Even that piece was largely non-substantive. I mean, she said, okay, so, CPS is going to be a cabinet-level position. I want the legislature to make it its own agency. But as anyone who pays any attention to these kinds of things knows, the devil's in the details. And the speech was short on details. I mean, on K-12 education, you mentioned that she talked about K-12. She spent six sentences on it, which is pretty light even for this governor. And even on the piece that she hit on tuition, it was largely short and non-substantive, and was only on about tuition and not on the larger chunk, which is the contribution that goes to higher education from the legislature, which she didn't address, which has been as volatile, if not more volatile, over the last decade than tuition has been. And so, I thought it was a little light. I think it'll be interesting to see how the session goes. And I think the relationship piece between her and the legislative leaders is going to be the most interesting thing to watch during this session.
I think that Governor Brewer feels she's already established her legacy. And so in this last session, she simply is going, as a lame duck. She is still relevant because she's got a veto stamp on the budget. And I think she's going to fight for her budget priorities, which we'll find out more about that on Friday when she makes her budget recommendations. Mm-hmm. Clearly, a big wad of new money will have to go to CPS. But also, I think dealing with the CPS crises is the one thing that could hurt her legacy, so she's trying to take decisive action on that. But I didn't expect anything else but a light speech with regards to other issues, because I think her clout is diminished with regards to general policy issues. I will say, and I know you're going to talk in depth on CPS in a few minutes when we're through, but I will say that I think ideally, if you're going with a new agency that she has deemed in crisis, you'd sort of like to see a national search for a director with a strong children's services background, as opposed to just naming someone real quickly like she has with Flanagan, who's a quality person. But that's politically driven because she's a lame duck. I mean, how do you get people across the nation to apply for the directorship when they don't even know really who's going to be governor a year from now? And would a new governor want them? So really, she probably did the only thing she could do, take a competent director that she has that's involved in the care study and so forth that she's appointed, and make them a director. So I think she's coped with this the best she can, but one would hope we'll see some great long-term recommendations coming from the care, and that there will be more substance in a few weeks.
David, I want to come back more generally and come back to CPS if you want to comment on that, but what Chris said about the governor already cementing her legacy. You know, has there been anything impactful? I presume when you were in the legislature, you and the governor didn't agree on too many things, but people have given her a lot of credit, as Chris did, for being out front, being a leader on the Prop 100 temporary sales tax increase, also the Medicaid expansion. But are those things that indicate leadership to you, or are those things that indicate this might be the brighter direction, but it isn't really, she's not really the leader. She didn't really have any great vision for her administration.
You know, I would disagree with even my own Democratic colleagues who might say that she's not taken a strong stance and been a leader on some of these issues, because most certainly on Medicaid expansion, she dug in her heels and she drew a line in the sand, and she, you know, did some hard tactic negotiations with the legislature, which is why there's a lot of the divisions that there are right now, especially within the Republican caucuses. And so, you know, I think that that's certainly going to be part of her legacy, that she was seen as someone who really did dig her heels in. I think the other part of her legacy, which kind of goes along with that, is she wasn't the kind of governor who worked closely with the legislature to debate the issues of the day and to come to a consensus or to reach maybe a logical conclusion. She was certainly the kind of governor who came into legislative sessions year after year with her own agenda. And the things that were listed on her agenda oftentimes were lines in the sand, and very rarely was she willing to, you know, negotiate the finer details of the issues. And so she was either successful or unsuccessful on each of those issues. There really wasn't a middle ground. And I think it was pretty common for the folks at the legislature to know and to understand that you had to play ball if you wanted to get anything done with the governor in any given year. And so I think Prop 100 and Medicaid are certainly parts of her legacy, but you also have to think about SB 1070. Now, SB 1070 is probably the exception in that she wasn't the leader in any way, shape, or form on that issue. She wasn't, she didn't dig her heels in. I think, you know, looking back from a historian's perspective, if you want an accurate portrayal of that situation, as opposed to, I think, what a lot of the media coverage showed, which was that she was a leader, if you want an accurate portrayal, you would remember that she waited until, I believe it was the fifth day, which is the last day that she had an option of whether to sign or veto. And the word coming out of the governor's office during the four prior days was that she was tossing it around and trying to figure out where she was going to land on it. And, you know, she was pretty wishy-washy on 1070 until she finally signed it. And, of course, after that, she realized that it was going to help her in the polls, and it probably won her re-election, or at least, you know, made the re-election the landslide that it was. And so I think, you know, we can't forget that 1070 is a part of her legacy, but I think a historian's view has to consider that, you know, her role in 1070 might be a little bit different than what was portrayed in the media at the time.
Chris, jump in.
I just want to make the point that I think the governor did what she had to do, and that is set her own agenda and do her own thing, because she was serving as governor at the very time that the Republican Party was being taken over by the Tea Party. And even this very conservative governor wasn't looking conservative enough to the Tea Party. And her priorities are different than the Tea Party priorities in many areas. So I think she pretty much had to draw a line in the sand, and she skillfully and politically was able to get get a lot accomplished. But I do agree with David. 1070 will be part of her legacy, in my opinion, a negative legacy. But that was the one time she let a legislator by the name of Russell Pierce take the lead. And I think in the history books, she'll regret that.
Now, you both have been lawmakers in the past, and I'm curious about your impression. David, first with you, is there a feeling that because of the governor's experience as a state lawmaker, she brought something different to the table? Is that something that helps someone as a governor into the future here in Arizona?
You know, it's an interesting perspective because, you know, certainly we've had you know, folks on both sides, and I know that we have some former legislators who are running currently, at least on the Republican side in the primary. I do think it gives you a different perspective. I think being knowledgeable about the way the legislature works and the way that the relational issues that come with being in the legislature, I think that's important. But I think that can be easily supplanted by having people on your staff and on your team who are understanding of those relationships and their importance. You know, what's unique about Arizona compared to some states is because of the term limits that we have in Arizona, there are very few people in the legislature that even really recall what kind of a legislator Jan Brewer was or especially those who have served with her. I don't know if maybe other than Debbie McCune Davis, I don't know if anyone else might have served with her, and Debbie might not have, thinking back. Jack Brown, who just left a few years ago, certainly served with her. But, you know, it's a little different in Arizona because it's not like she has a bunch of people who know her style, having worked directly one-on-one with her in the legislature. But I think it is a little helpful that she gets the relational structure in the legislature. But, you know, again, that can be supplanted by having people on your staff who know it, too.
About 30 years ago, I was a freshman legislator with Jan Brewer and in the House. And you're right. I think most people don't even remember her then as a legislator. I think the fact that she went on to become a senator and then a supervisor and then secretary of the state, cumulative, that gave her tremendous experience and I think broadened her horizons. I would also like to point out that with regards to CPS and her executive order, I think she will be remembered for expanding the office of governor. From a historical standpoint, that's important. This isn't the first time she's taken executive action on her own and then demanded that the legislature capitulate by changing the statutes to make CPS a freestanding agency. She did it really with the Commerce Authority and the abolishing the Commerce Department. It's interesting because she's doing it as a governor what President Barack Obama has done skillfully with executive orders at the national level. Executives that take this type of action and basically go around the legislature and force them to capitulate often go down in the history books as effective executives.
I want to close with a hypothetical question because I like to rewrite history on the program once in a while. I like to have a fun conversation as it relates to this. David, let me start with you. What would have been different, let's say, if Janet Napolitano had stayed? I'm not talking about her in and of itself, but let's say in 2010, if we hadn't had an incumbent Governor Brewer, how do you think the state would have been different? How do you think things would have been handled differently? I'm not even talking about the candidates, if we don't remember who would have been the lead for the Republicans at that point, but how big a difference would that have made? Many people have talked about Janet Napolitano was kind of the veto stamp in many ways, but what if we had just had someone where 1070 wouldn't have made a big difference because there wouldn't have really been an incumbent to run at that point?
Well, I think it would be a huge difference, and I can speak from experience. You know, I was there the last 2 years of Governor Napolitano's term in office as governor, and I was there when Jan Brewer was sworn in, and they tore out the rose bushes in the courtyard so that she could have a big coronation. So I saw the before and after, and it was a stark difference. But there's another huge factor that came in there, and that is that, you know, right as the governor, Governor Napolitano left, is when we went into a recession. And so the budget years were totally different post-Napolitano and during Napolitano's administration. But the other thing that was different was when you have a Democratic governor, regardless of how distinct the minority is, and frankly, when Napolitano left, it was, I believe it was 27 Democrats to 33 Republicans in the House and fairly balanced in the Senate. But when you have a Democratic governor, the Democrats have a voice in the process. And so the Democrats had the opportunity in her last couple years to work with Tim Bee in the Senate to craft some budgets and to get some bills through. And you actually had negotiations and you had all parties at the table, especially in the budget process.
David, we've got less than a minute.
I'm going
to have Chris jump in. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Okay, I was just going to say, as soon as she was gone, that changed completely.
You know, 1070 would have never happened, and the image of Arizona on immigration would have been very different if Napolitano had been in office. But actually, in other areas, such as the budget and dealing with the recession, I don't think things would have been that different. I think Napolitano would have gladly taken the stimulus dollars, would have supported a penny cent on the sales tax. I think Napolitano would have embraced a bipartisan Medicaid expansion and a budget passage in 2013, where the Democrats did get to play with the pragmatic Republicans and Governor Brewer. So with the huge exception of illegal immigration, which is major, I think with regards to coping with the recession, I know Brewer wouldn't like to hear this, but I think her activities and her policies would have actually been very similar to Napolitano because it was the only way to go.
Former member of the board.
The big cuts to education would have been different.
David, thanks for the time. David Shapira, Chris Hurstam, appreciate it. Thanks very much, guys.
Thank you.